I'd like now like to welcome Dr. Michelle Polacek. Dr. Michelle Polacek has worked in Maine for the past 16 years, first at the Maine Center for Public Health in Augusta, Maine, and more recently at the University of New England School of Community and Population Health in Portland, Maine, as a faculty member in the Public Health Program. Michelle's work focuses on chronic disease prevention and childhood obesity. Please welcome Dr. Polacek.
Good afternoon. So I'm going to be speaking about a health impact assessment for a sugary drink excise tax for the state of Maine. And I work with a little group called the Maine Prevention Research Center, which is a collaboration between the Harvard Prevention Research Center, currently UNE, and the State Health Department. And we have a steering group, and our steering group asks us to conduct a health impact assessment to gear up for potential legislation in the next, from now on, the next legislative session. Because we, a few years back, had a sugar-sweetened beverage tax bill repealed by referendum. So we thought we could get on board with thinking about all of the different issues that go along with developing new legislation early. I have no relationships to disclose. So I want to start with the definition of sugar-sweetened beverages. Any beverage with added sugar or other caloric sweeteners, such as high fructose corn syrup, including soda, sports drinks, fruit drinks, tea, flavored enhanced waters, and energy drinks. And why sugar-sweetened beverage tax? Well, our colleague Steve Gortmaker, I think, said it well. Sugar-sweetened beverages are a unique nutritional villain. And I say this because, and I think we all know this already, so I won't spend a lot of time, but sugar-sweetened beverages are the single leading contributor to the obesity epidemic. And people drink, on average, 42 gallons per person per year in this country. Every additional daily soda increases obesity risk by 60% in children, and we absorb sugar faster from liquids, and we don't compensate for liquid calories the way we do for other kinds of calories. And I think it's pretty clear that we have, at this point, pretty solid evidence connecting sugar-sweetened beverages and obesity, and I won't spend time on these either because I'm sure you're all quite aware of this evidence. Just want to spend a moment, though, on the Lancet series of papers in 2011 and talk about a few key messages from that series of papers, which is that changes in the global food system, including reductions in easy availability of cheap food, seem to be the major drivers of the rise in the global obesity epidemic, and that substantial differences in national and local environments produce the variation in the obesity prevalence recorded across populations. And I know you can't see everything on this, but I just want to point out this is a figure from that Lancet series, all the way to the left where the systemic drivers live there, which are the policy and economic systems that enable and promote high growth and consumption. Those, if you impact those, they have the greatest effect on populations, but you know they are potentially the most politically difficult to enact. So there are 10 recommended strategies that ChangeLab Solutions has put out to limit sugar-sweetened beverages in the community. This is kind of an ecological perspective of how to do that. And strategy number 9 is a sugar-sweetened beverage tax. In 2012, APHA came out with a tax policy statement which said that decisive public health policy measures must be implemented to counteract the rising rates of sugar-sweetened beverage consumption among children and adults in this country, and that a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages could discourage purchasing of these drinks. And this has really become a national conversation in the last year about 10 states or 11 states tried to pass sugar-sweetened beverage tax bills. None of them did, and there were a couple of local city or local municipalities that tried as well. As I said, in 2008, the Maine legislature passed, and then Governor Baldacci signed into law an increase on tax on soda, beer, and wine. And the law would replace what Maine DIRIGO is, Maine's attempt at universal health care. And the way it was paid for was formula. It was basically a surcharge on insurance claims. And every year the legislature had to fight for this. And this tax effort was meant to pay for that. And so, unfortunately, there was a referendum and an appeal, repeal that went through. So key assumptions for our HIA, and we use the NPLANS model tax legislation as the basis for our discussions with our stakeholders. So we would tax sugar-sweetened beverages only. It would be passed on to the consumer. We would use a 1 cent per ounce tax, although we discussed other models. And then we would create a children's health promotion fund with the revenue. So where we are now, we've completed screening. We're most of the way through scoping. We're in the midst of risk assessment. So this is in process. We never had any formal training on HIA, so I just want to put that out there. And we're learning. We've used the resources that the Health Impact Project has provided, and that's been wonderful. But so we're working our way through this, and we're fortunate to have others who have gone through this before us. Okay, so we started with a very rudimentary tax impact logic model to, you know, kind of jumpstart the conversation with our stakeholders. A tax impacting sales, revenue, and then potentially, if there were earmarks, public health programming to improve policies, environments, and health for children. We know that beverage sales can spur on reformulation, potentially vendor revenue, and if vendor revenue were impacted, then we might impact also the economy or workforce and their access to health insurance, food security. And we know that beverage sales impact consumption and obesity and health, and all these things are connected through the education that the public health programming would provide. So that's where we started. And then June through October in 2013, we did a bunch of stakeholder interviews, both in terms of group interviews, and we interviewed individuals as well. In total, 31 people attended a meeting or were interviewed. And I just want to point out that we had a lot of the sort of public health advocate types and advocate organizations. We had some national organizations, Maine affiliates of national organizations as well. But we also reached out to individual grocers, the Maine Grocers Association, Maine Restaurant Association, as well as the Maine Beverage Association. And these stakeholder meetings were great, I think, laid a foundation for our future collaboration for this issue and other issues moving forward. So this is, I just want to say, and a lot of our scoping findings weren't directly relevant to the next steps for our HIA, but I want to just point out a few kind of interesting things. We heard from industry that they would not support a sugar-sweetened beverage tax no matter what, that it was, others told us that it would be better to exempt milk, that a teaspoon, a 1 cent per teaspoon tax would be better than a 1 cent per ounce tax, et cetera. So, you know, these kinds of things that we heard really are going to point us toward the literature and looking at what's already known about what works and what might have the most impact. We also learned that a fund, a children's health fund, would be better to have a separate fund that, for example, the legislature couldn't raid every year. So people were afraid that if we created a fund that was part of other funds that were already out there, then it could potentially put those monies in peril. So we knew right away, I'm sorry, my slides are a little messed up. I think it's the Mac to PC conversion. But we knew we had to do a modeling on tax revenue, BMI, and obesity, and then health effects. So I just want to walk you through, before I get to that, we thought that others are doing this work as well. And so our real contribution could be Maine-specific revenue. BMI, obesity shifts. We'd look at diabetes because of their immediate impacts. And then we thought we would look at dental caries because there's a real lack potentially in the literature around that and associated healthcare costs. So I just want to walk you through kind of our thinking around revenue, BMI, and obesity, and some of the other impacts. And just know that we're in the middle of this, and we will probably likely use a couple of different ways of getting to these calculations. So we're going to start out with sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. Eventually, we want to look at Maine-specific trends here, but right now we're going to be using national data, national consumption rates, and really just using Maine population numbers to look at the revenue for Maine. And then we apply price elasticity, which is the expected change in consumer demand based on, in this case, a 1 cent per ounce tax for sugar-sweetened beverages only. So price elasticity is different, for example, if you tax both sugar-sweetened beverages and diet beverages, and it's higher for just the sugar-sweetened beverages. And then applying an average cost calculated by Frank Chalupka and colleagues in Illinois for the sugar-sweetened beverages, and then the 1 cent per ounce tax, which is conservatively 20%, we get revenue. And so we didn't have to do this calculation ourselves because the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity has created a tax revenue calculator. And so I put in, I use this to calculate and project out Maine revenue for 2014, and that would be almost $55.5 million. So eventually we want to do better than this. We want to look at Maine-specific demographics and shifts and trends because we have an older population in Maine, and the beverage consumption is going to be different for that population than average populations for the country. So how will we get a change in BMI and obesity? Well, this we used Lynn and colleagues' model, and I'll just kind of walk you through that. Lynn and colleagues looked at both high-income and low-income sales consumption trends, and I averaged those to get just an overall 438 grams for daily for adults and 494 grams daily for children, and then applying the price they applied, this price elasticity, and it looks like they used a 10% substitution, and it looks that way because I compared the net calorie change that they observed to the calorie change just from sugar-sweetened beverages that they observed. And they got, therefore, shifts in sales/consumption frequencies. We have to make the assumption that sales equals consumption. And then they came up with a calorie reduction of 36 kilocalories per day for adults and for children 44 kilocalories per day less due to the tax. And then they used a dynamic shift in weight model, which oftentimes there's a static model that's used converting kilocalories 3,500 kilocalories per pound lost, but they used a model that took into account body fat and muscle mass and came up with this. And you'll note it's much lower than the 3,500 kilocalorie conversion amount. In the first year, one loses the most, 0.97 kilograms. This is for adults, and these are cumulative. So by years 5 and 6. It's pretty much a flattened out in terms of weight loss. Then we applied NHANES anthropometrics from 2008 to get the desired age and gender categories for Maine, and weight loss and BMI for Maine. And that's how we ended up with shifts in Maine BMI. And eventually, we'd like to be able to convert that to shifts in Maine obesity. But I thought I would show you what we got here for the Maine BMI shifts, and you see a typo under females, it should be BMI 1 year, 3 years, 6 years. I apologize for that, and I guess my newest one didn't load, but that's okay. As you can see, most of the BMI drop is in year one, and it sort of levels out by year six, both for males and females. And overall, we really by the sixth year only see in this dynamic weight model, about 6/10 of a BMI unit drop over six years, both for males, a little tiny little bit more for females. So how do we get to reduction in adult obesity-related health care spending? Well, one way to do it would be to look at Maine-specific shifts in BMI converted to shifts in obesity, the calculation that I just did, and then apply age and gender-specific obesity-related spending per person per year. And we and colleagues have done that so we could apply their formulations for those specific age and gender categories, and then we would end up with healthcare spending reductions due to taxation. But we're so far from that right now that another kind of simpler way to do this would be to look at the number of obese adults in Maine using NHANES and U.S. Census estimates for, let's say, Maine 2014, applying this rate that, again, Chalupka and colleagues found in their study in Illinois, and apply that to get adult obesity reduction for the 1 cent tax. And so we end up with 13,000 and a third less obese adults in Maine, applying $1,500 cost savings per adult, which is actually a pretty conservative figure. Compared to what others have found, we end up with over $20 million in healthcare cost savings for Maine. So again, we don't know which way we're going to go with, but we'd like to get as specific to Maine populations as we can. Impact on children is a little bit harder because you don't see savings, healthcare savings right away for kids. And what does this 44 kilocalories a day mean? Well, there are a number of ways we can look at energy gap and look at the amount of the energy gap that's filled by that. And so if we're looking at 120 kilocalorie a day energy gap as calculated by Wang and Gortmaker, it would be about 37%. If we use a 200 kilocalorie gap, it would be approximately 22% of that energy gap in kids. So in terms of where we go next, we have to continue to work on this obesity prevalence and cost, and then we'll be moving on to diabetes prevalence and cost, and then we'll be building our model for, hopefully, for caries prevalence and cost soon. And we're also going to be looking at where our stakeholders kind of pointed us, you know, really try to explore the ease of implementation of these different models and how much they would cost, industry participation, and then this issue of vendor revenue and other impacts. And I was at the Harvard's Choices presentation yesterday, and Lisa Powell stood up and said that she had, over the last year, done a study that looked at this very issue. So I think we'll use her work to look at the vendor revenue and other impacts. And then we'll reconnect with our stakeholders to make recommendations, decide if there will be language for legislation, and perhaps other recommendations such as voluntary measures, and decide who will be interested in the results, recommendations, and how to get that information across. And that's what I have. So I guess we're taking questions. Yes. Well, I think that's a great question, and I mean that gets at the issue of substitution. And so the model that I looked at, the LINS model, it looked like there was a 10% substitution back to other caloric food or beverage items. And I can't answer the question about whether you lose your taste for sugar over time. I personally imagine you might, but I'm not sure that I can answer that. Maybe someone else could. Right. Right.
I'm just wondering if you can clarify something for me.
Sure.
So I understood you to say that the excise tax would result in 6/10 of 1 BMI
unit.
Over 6 years.
Yes.
So that seems Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering how you get from there to significant reduction in obesity rates. I'm having a hard time connecting.
So we haven't modeled the BMI shift to obesity rates yet, and I'm going to be looking to some colleagues to help with that. So the way that others have modeled this is a much larger BMI drop, much larger obesity change due to the tax because of that 3,500 calorie thing. That's not the dynamic shift in weight. So we're going with the dynamic shift in weight. Maybe we'll do them both and look at the difference. Maybe I think we'll be looking at different models, but you're absolutely right. It's really small compared to what we're used to seeing. Yeah. Sure. Yes.
I wondered if what you're seeing in your models resonates with your stakeholders. If you engage with some of the communities and you've heard similar stories about substitution, that's one question. The second would be, there's literature out there suggesting that artificially sweetened beverages have similar implications for obesity and diabetes, and if the substitution might be to those beverages, then your tax wouldn't help any.
That's true. Although my understanding is that, just to get at your last question first, is that there isn't really enough research right now that we can say that definitively. So I guess the jury's still out on that. And so maybe the thing to do is to tax them both and hope that people substitute to other non-obesity promoting beverages. And your first question was whether our stakeholders, whether this resonates with them. I don't know yet because we haven't really brought it back to our stakeholders, but we will. So maybe at the next APHA I'll be able to present the final. Yeah.
We're going to save the rest of the questions for after.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.